From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, we hear about a project that teaches teens how to deal with tricky community issues.
Race is definitely a really big thing, I feel like, not only just in our school. I feel like outside of the classroom, it's kind of segregated.
Then we'll go inside San Quentin to hear stories of changing allegiances.
I feel loyalty now to my family, the people that's been holding me down, who had my back through my incarceration.
And we'll hear what it's like to be released from a life sentence in prison.
There are cars whizzing by. It's loud. There's so much open space. No lines to stay within.
Figuring out where you belong today on Cross Currents. In February, an unusual cultural mashup went down at the YMCA in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood.
Hello, everybody! Happy New Year! Happy Black History!
The event's menu was also an unconventional mix, offering both cornbread and bok choy. And for entertainment, African dance. And lion dance. Depending on who you ask, this kind of side-by-side harmony hasn't always been the case in the Bayview, a place with its share of tensions in the past few years, especially between the Black and Asian communities. But Bayview organizations are hoping to bring the community together with events like these. And one of their tactics? A new group called the Bayview Youth Advocates. KLW's Liz Mack has the story.
Yeah, come in, take a seat.
20 teenagers are settling into a classroom at this year's Bayview Youth Summit. After a few minutes, they're quiet, eyes focused on someone their own age who's leading this race and racism workshop.
This is like an example of how African Americans are portrayed in media, even to like in Disney.
So that's right, Disney. They're watching a clip of Dumbo projected on the whiteboard.
Did you ever see an elephant fly? Well, I seen a horse fly. Ah, I seen a dragon fly.
It's an exercise to get these teenagers to talk about racial stereotypes. In the clip, the crows are Black. They're portrayed as lazy and uneducated. And one of the crows is named Jim, as in Jim Crow. This is part of the Bayview Youth Advocates curriculum. The goal is to groom the neighborhood's future leaders by teaching young people about the area's cultural history. The hope is they'll pass on those lessons and feel a sense of ownership over where they live. Today, the teen leaders are talking about some hard but important topics. There's a recent history of racial tensions in the area.
I am Hui Lan Chang. I was the woman who was thrown off the platform of the third line, T line.
This is a recording from a San Francisco Board of Supervisors meeting in 2010. The woman you hear speaking, whose words are being translated from Chinese, she was thrown off a muni platform in the Bayview by a handful of Black teenagers.
I came to the U.S. because I really hoped that I could be able to have a good life and achieve the American dream to be able to live in peace.
Two more attacks repeating that racial dynamic occurred. The tension was amplified. Many of the Asian community felt like they were being targeted. And a lot of the Black community felt like they were being blamed for the actions of a few kids.
They look at the facts just on the surface, you know, it's the Blacks attacking the Asians.
That's Eddie Zhang. He works with the Asian community in the Bayview and came up with the idea for the Bayview Youth Advocates. He says back in 2010, he heard comments like,
why is this Black people attacking us? You know, why did they take advantage of us? We don't have money either. We are poor also.
The rift wasn't lost on the Black community either.
I remember my mom saying to me, you know, when I get on the buses, there's so much tension where you see people sitting in the front, people sitting in the back. The division was really clear.
That's Gina Fromer, the former executive director at the Bayview Hunters Point YMCA. She's African-American and was born and raised in the Bayview herself. And just like Zhang, she says this racial tension came from misunderstandings on both sides.
she ticks off some of the stereotypes she heard about the Asian community back then.
They're takers. They don't shop there. They might go, they'd leave the community to go shop other places.
Meanwhile, Zhang says he was hearing stereotypes from some Asians directed at the black community.
They don't go get a job, they don't work, you know, they're lazy, why don't they just go to school?
I think some of the perceptions were that the Chinese community, they didn't speak to African Americans.
They created this like, oh, you're suffering and my suffering, you know, just going back and forth regarding that and not really talking about solutions.
Frommer and Zhang, both community organizers, said that neither of the groups really knew each other, and they didn't understand that there were larger forces at play. Language barriers, for one, and poverty. In 2011, about 20% of the neighborhood lived under the poverty level. The area has its challenges, but Zhang says it's important to instill community pride in these kids.
It's a ripple effect, right? So when you empower the young people, when they start taking ownership of their community, then they would want to change the community.
Which is how a group of kids came to be playing a social justice game in another Youth Summit classroom. John Vuong is a high school senior leading this workshop.
Race is definitely a really big thing, I feel like, not only just in our school. I feel like outside of the classroom, it's kind of segregated. People hang out with their own kind. And I felt like it's just, they do that because they're more comfortable with the people around them.
Oh, three.
He and the other youth advocates have been working on the summit for months. The idea being, if young people teach other young people about the issues in their community, it can have a deeper impact.
Hello, guys. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
These are some group agreements. I'll read it out to you guys. Respect each other and yourself. Be positive and encouraging. Step up, step back. Be supportive of each other.
Clean John and a fellow youth advocate, Brian Britt, are leading a workshop about the school-to-prison pipeline.
Yeah. And we're just saying these group agreements because, like, at the end, we're going to have, like, a bunch of, like, serious conversations about these topics, and it might be, like, shocking. Remember to, like, respect each other's opinions and stuff like that.
This is all a part of the group's larger goals, to increase empathy among people of all kinds for people who are different than them. John says these workshops can be a way for other teenagers to address big issues about the neighborhood that they don't normally get a chance to.
So School to Prison Pipeline then. So this one, yeah.
This one?
Perfect, yeah.
This workshop is called the School to Prison Pipeline because it addresses the fact that certain people, people of color, are set up by the system and at higher risk of going to prison. I ask senior Abdul Benturkia why he came.
You could see, like, I think I'm pretty sure that 50% of people here, like, they're family members are in jail or something. I just want to learn more about it because you don't get to see it outside, you know, because people are afraid to talk about it, but here it's like, it's all out, you know, it's all in the open.
Brian and John, who are teaching the workshop, are Asian, and they're teaching a group of largely black and brown high schoolers about a system that disproportionately affects kids like them. So in this kind of scenario, how did these teenagers actually teach other teenagers about things as tricky as race? Because the school-to-prison pipeline is a pretty big concept, Brian and John set up a game to illustrate it.
On each table, there's a scenario, if you look. So it'll go from 6th grade to 7th grade to 8th grade to 9th
grade. At each table, there's a sheet of paper, one for each grade, from 6th to 12th, with a different scenario. You roll a dice, and the number determines your fate.
You went camping last weekend and forgot that your pocket knife was still in your backpack. Roll one or two and nobody notices. You take it out when you get home from school. Proceed to next grade.
Roll three or four and your bag got searched during a routine bag check. You tell the truth, the school officials believe you, but you still get suspended.
Roll five or six and there was a routine check back. You tell your story, but there was zero tolerance policy. Proceed to juvie.
That's juvenile hall.
All right, go again. Go again. Back to juvie.
Back to juvie.
Midway through the game, Brian asks me how it's going.
I mean, how do you feel about this, like, this game so far?
It's pretty bleak.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's actually pretty much the point of the game, actually. To show, like, some students actually go through some of this stuff, like, going to juvie, like, three or four times, getting suspended multiple times just for, like, simple acts. So, I mean, this is a reality for some people. And we just want to, like, show them, like, it's frustrating, but there are ways out of this situation. All right, guys. I mean, overall, how that felt? All right, we'll start over here.
I feel that, like, all this is real, like, this happened to real people, and, like, I try the best that it won't happen to me.
The game was cool, but it got me a little irritated because it made me think, like, does this really happen to, like, people like, younger than us? And, like, what if they don't go to college at all because of that?
The teens may have started the morning sleepy, but by the time this exercise is over, their eyes are wide open.
Was there anything in particular you wanted people to leave the workshop with?
Honestly, just keeping an open mind and being more informed about it. And the most important thing is just to share this knowledge of what you have.
And that's the whole point. Youth Advocates teaches teens like Brian and John that their best asset is what they have to say. And they're using that to give others a chance to have their say too. For Cross Currents, I'm Liz Mack. KLW's Melanie Young helped with reporting on that story. It's part of our Sights and Sounds of Bayview project, which shines a spotlight on one of San Francisco's most diverse neighborhoods. A multimedia version of the piece will be part of KLW's live storytelling event June 19th at the Joseph Lee Rec Center in San Francisco at 7 p.m., and it's free. Find more information at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Learning where you fit in your community isn't just something that happens when you're a teenager. It's a process that many of us work on throughout our lives, as we'll hear in our next story from the San Quentin Prison Report.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
Bringing you hidden stories from life inside.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell. You see what goes on.
As I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You can hear a pin drop.
Gang affiliation is a big part of life for a lot of men in San Quentin. Though being in a gang often means violence, it also offers a sense of belonging. But as we'll hear, gang loyalty can end tragically when members end up betrayed by the very same people they sought to impress. This is the story of three men who misplaced their loyalty and in each case ended up with life sentences. From SQPR, Lewis A. Scott has the story.
My name is Kana Uch. I've been incarcerated for 13 years. I committed a crime of murder, first degree, gang-related. I'm Asian-American. My sentence is 25 years to life.
Uch says that his misconception of loyalty began at home.
So I grew up in a household with a father who was abusive. I believed that I was no good, which caused me to feel very low about myself. And that right there made me more gullible, more easily to be manipulated, more prone to give in to peer pressure.
The attraction to things that he had been deprived of as a child was one of the factors that drew him to the gang life. This ultimately led to him committing his crime and coming to prison.
For me, it was wanting materialistic things, wanting to fit in with my peers.
This is where Uch experienced his second betrayal. First at home by his father, and now in prison. He was betrayed by his gang, the very same people he chose to kill for.
My homies never once came see me or sent me anything or wrote me or they've all just deserted me.
After being in prison a few years, Uch received a visit from his mother and his sister, and that's when he made a surprising discovery.
And seeing my mom's tears come out of her eyes and seeing how older she was getting, and I started to realize all of the times they'd been there for me and thinking how ungrateful I was during that time. From then I started seeing my friends in a different light. I started to see who my real friends were, and my real friends are my sister and my mom.
I'm Dante Smith. I'm 34 years old, African-American male. Committed my crime when I was 16, came to jail when I was 17. I've been incarcerated for the past 17 and a half years, and I am currently serving a life sentence for a second-degree murder.
Smith killed a man who was alleged to have shot his godmother. But when Smith was arrested for the crime, he was shocked to discover that the same individual who introduced him to gang life was the same person who turned him in.
He was an older homie, somebody that I had looked up to growing up, somebody that, like I said, who had raised me when I was in the streets. When I went and retaliated, he ended up getting caught up for some other things, and he ended up telling the police that I was the one who had did the killing, and he was the one who come to court on me and testified on me.
Being betrayed by the man he looked up to was a devastating lesson for Smith. He wants others to know the consequences of loyalty when it is misguided.
I would tell them that it ain't real, that it's really no such thing as gang loyalty. The majority of the gang life is really you out for self.
In prison, Smith began to view things differently.
Once I seen that it wasn't no loyalty there, I started to educate myself.
Smith says he has a different understanding of what loyalty means.
I feel loyalty now to my family, the people that's been holding me down, who had my back through my incarceration. But the majority of the homies that I was around and I grew up with and the ones that raised me know that it's no loyalty there.
This feeling of being misguided when in a gang does not discriminate. It crosses across racial lines.
My name is Christopher Gallo, V16162. I was convicted of a felony third strike armed robbery.
Fairly young in life, Chris was led to believe that he had to make a loyalty choice based on his race.
I grew up in Orange County, California. And the neighborhood I was from had limited exposure to diversity. So when I joined the street life, all of my homeboys were either skinheads or Nazi lowriders. And to gain acceptance, that was the norm.
Gallo remembers a very violent past.
As a skinhead, you automatically volunteered yourself for what they call missions, where you will go out and put violent intentions on people.
Gallo's violence against others landed him in prison. But once here, he began to question his skinhead values, to really confront his worldview. He questioned his connection to the gang in thought.
They've done nothing. Filled me with promises to begin with, but then, all good things come to an end.
While in prison, Chris grew his hair out. He disassociated himself from the skinheads, as well as the past that once ruled his world.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt. So I've had to come to grips with all the damage and destruction I've done in my life and take responsibility for it, my dirt, in order to grow myself.
Now Chris has a very different view on the inclusive possibility of loyalty. He now has loyalty too.
My daughter, my family, myself, the human race, people.
This is Lewis A. Scott reporting for SQPR.
For more SQPR stories, go to KALW.org and click on San Quentin Prison Report.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. When it comes to locking up young people, the United States leads the industrialized world. And though youth incarceration rates have been declining for the last two decades, adult prisons still contain many inmates who entered the system as juveniles with life sentences. These prisoners have grown up and lived their entire adult lives behind bars. So what happens to these adults if and when they're released and have to re-enter a society they last knew as teenagers? A new documentary film, Life After Life, explores that question by following three men incarcerated in their teens as they leave San Quentin and try to forge new lives on the outside. KALW's Jen Sheehan sat down with Tamara Perkins, who produced and directed Life After Life.
You first went to San Quentin Prison as a yoga and meditation instructor, right?
Yes.
So tell me about how you got from there to making this film, Life After Life.
Okay, so I was brought into San Quentin by Alameda County Public Health. This was in 2006. I was there really working with lifers, so men who would not be able to go home unless they were found suitable by a parole board. That basically meant that they had to do a lot of work before they could come home. And some of the men found out that I was also a filmmaker and asked me to tell their story. And I said yes.
And what did that mean to you at the moment? What did that mean to them to tell their story?
I think they really felt invisible. You know, these are the folks that are forgotten. So at that point, in general, lifers were not being released in California. And so they were doing all this work to help, you know, do this self-development and actually support men who are on determinate sentencing, so who were going home, but really with no hope or not a lot of hope of ever actually going home. So I think that they saw a chance to be able to have a voice, to put a human face on the category that they've been given.
Life After Life tells the stories of three different men, all leaving San Quentin having been paroled from life sentences. They're different ages, but were all arrested at 17 and have served between 10 and 30 years behind bars. You filmed them over a number of years. 8 years, you said, you've been working on the film. Mm-hmm. How did you decide to follow these particular men?
So I actually thought I was going to do a film that was only set inside San Quentin because nobody was getting released. And then suddenly, in 2010, two men, Noel and Harrison, were released within a few months of each other.
And these were men who were taking your yoga class?
Yes, uh-huh. They were, actually. Noel, not as often, but Harrison, very religiously. So I did know them both really well.
And so then you were already making a film about them, and then they got released. What was your thought process around what the film was going to become then?
Well, I realized that there were a lot of program films, really just about the group that they were in or something that's inside San Quentin. But what I hadn't seen was something that allows you to go on a journey with the men. And I realized that that's probably what we needed to see. We needed to see them come home. We needed to see them stumble, in some cases fail, and hopefully in some cases succeed. I mean, and anything from, you know, difficult moments with family to deaths and births.
The film really does capture a lot of those really personal moments, like you said, deaths and births and these first moments for the men as they come out into the outside world after being in for 20 years, for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a clip from the movie. Can you explain what's happening here in this clip?
Yes. So Harrison had...
And Harrison, who had been in prison for 21 years.
For 21 years. He went to prison when he was 17. So he was staying at a halfway house. Suddenly, in a space where there are cars whizzing by, it's loud. There's so much open space, no lines to stay within. And, you know, he's really affected by it.
When I first got out, the first day, I walked to this corner right here with a cup of coffee talking to my roommate. And, you know, he saw that I was really nervous walking down here with all the cars going by. And, you know, we walked to the corner and every time I kept walking, I kept wanting to head back. We just stood here. I mean, we just stood here for about 15 minutes and I was wondering. And I told him, man, people probably think we're crazy, man, just standing here drinking coffee and looking at the cars going by. You know, my legs are shaking and I don't know why, but it's just still difficult. It's difficult just to stand here. And I suppose this will be my test, you know, if I can just walk out here and just stand out here and not feel all those sort of feelings come up like that, that then I'll know, like, okay, you know, I'm here. This is where I belong.
And you said that the men were really open and wanting to tell their own stories, but were there moments for them that they felt too vulnerable to share with you?
I think that one of the reasons that they were able to be vulnerable is that this happened over a number of years. So by the time Noel and Harrison were released, I'd known them for almost 4 years. And I think even just knowing that I'm going to continue to show up and trusting what I'm going to do with the film I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah. And what are your hopes for the film? What do you hope that viewers are going to take away from it, and where do you want it to go?
I really want it to reach the widest possible audience. I can see that this will be something, again, to bring voice, but then also getting beyond the choir and getting out to folks who don't understand, don't know, and have not had any exposure, and maybe give them, you know, a different perspective. The original goal was to put a human face, you know, on incarceration, and that's still the main goal. I think that from there, what we can do is endless.
Tamara Perkins is the producer and director of the documentary Life After Life. She spoke with KALW's Jen Chien. The film is still in post-production, but you can catch a work-in-progress screening this Sunday at the Roxy in San Francisco as part of the 14th annual San Francisco Documentary Festival. More information is at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. Our team includes Olivia Cueva, Rachel Dornhell, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, Todd Whitney, and Liza Veal. Chris Hoff engineered today's show. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Janam from Oakland. Janam performs Saturday afternoon at Wisteria Way in Oakland. Music starts at 3 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.